Welcome to Spilling the Chemist Tea. I'm your host, Dr. Rachel Hall, the Director of Education, Outreach, and Diversity for the Center for Selective CH Functionalization, or CCHF, a National Science Foundation Center for Chemical Innovation. Today, I'm talking to a faculty member in CCHF, Dr. Christine Luscombe from the University of Washington, where she is the Campbell Career Development Endowed Professor of Materials Science and Engineering. Now, she is also the interim chair of the department, and along with that, she's also a professor of chemistry. She'll be leaving the U.S. this fall to join the faculty of Okinawa Institute of Science and Technology. I enjoyed talking with her, and I hope you enjoy hearing it. So who are you, and what are your pronouns?
I go by she, her, hers, and my name is Christine Luscombe.
Can you give me a brief high-level overview of your research?
Yeah, sure. So we work in the general area of organic electronics, and that can mean a lot of things. But for us, what we really focus on is trying to make semiconducting polymers with the level of accuracy that nature can. So thinking about things like how do you control molecular weights? How do you make sure that you end up with narrow dispersity molecular weight systems? And also thinking towards achieving sequence specificity in the polymers. And we want to be able to do this from like a synthetic point of view, that we're just interested in achieving greater control, but also in terms of trying to see if we can access properties that were not accessible before in these polymers by having such precise methods to make them.
Now let's go talk about the past a little bit.
Where did you grow up? So I was actually born in Japan. My mother is Japanese and my father is British, so mixed race. And so I was born in a city called Kobe, Japan. You might have heard of it from Kobe beef, but that's where the beef itself is from. Yeah, so I grew up there until I was 12. But then when I was 12, my parents wanted also for me to experience the British education system. So I went off to boarding school in the UK, and my parents stayed behind in Japan. So it was just me and my brother who went over to the UK. And so, yeah, I was in the UK wrapping up my undergraduate studies and also my PhD. And it's after that that I moved to the US for my postdoc.
What was your first experience with science?
That's really hard to say, but I was always more sort of scientifically inclined, even from a young age. Like my mom tells this story of how when I was in kindergarten, instead of drawing pictures, I would just write numbers all over and over again. Apparently I was really into numbers. Like even in grade school, I was really good at things like math. But I think probably the most memorable beginning is at the end of grade school. So when I was doing this transition from grade school to middle school, which is when I switched from a Japanese school to the British school, I had to take some entrance exams. And, you know, my education up to that point was all in Japanese, and I was suddenly switching to an English system. And of course, the exam was in English. So my dad was teaching me, trying to get me up to speed with everything. And as part of that, he taught some science as well. And so he actually bought a Bunsen burner, got some crucibles, and we burnt a few things at home, probably things that we shouldn't have done. doing these, those are my first ever chemistry experiments, I would say. And that was pretty memorable.
Yeah. Well, how did you decide to pursue chemistry?
So that happened more during high school. So in middle school, high school, I had this teacher called Mr. England, who was an amazing chemistry teacher. And a lot of the other students didn't like him. So he was one of those teachers who would go way past like the curriculum. And quite often, most students who weren't into it, they just wanted to stick to the curriculum and just get by with the bare minimum. But he was that teacher who insisted on going well beyond the curriculum and made sure that we understood the history and all of that. And he was also that guy who did the crazy experiments in class too. But I would say that he is really the primary driver for making me want to pursue chemistry in the first place. The British system is also a little bit different in that we specialize a lot earlier. In high school, we were down to studying only three subjects already. So when you apply to undergrad, you already apply to a specific major. And so, yeah, I had to make the decision pretty early on in high school. And yeah, I would say that he really helped to make that decision. So I had specialized to do math, physics, and chemistry, and I just gravitated more to the chemistry.
When and why did you decide to go to graduate school?
That's a trickier one. So I'm one of those people who never had a defining moment where it's like, okay, I'm going to be a professor. It was never like that. For me, it was more like, well, I'm kind of enjoying what I'm doing now, so I think I'm just going to keep doing it type thing.
Yeah.
So that was the same with grad school as well. So I was doing my undergraduate studies and I was like, well, yeah, I kind of want to keep studying. And the UK is a little bit different in that, you know, usually over here in the US, the people encourage you to change schools for undergrad to graduate school, but that's not necessarily the case in the UK. So I just kind of stayed on at the same place as I did my undergrad and continued to do my graduate studies. And in hindsight, maybe there's a part of me that wishes that I had been more intentional about that. Like I almost kind of just rolled into it.
But it still worked out. So
yeah, no,
it did. How was grad school? You know, what did you enjoy the most? And
what I enjoyed the most is the freedom. My advisor was quite a hands-off advisor, so on a day-to-day basis, like I decided what to do. So that was a lot of fun. Yeah, just the freedom to do whatever I wanted to do. The least one. So because my advisor was quite hands-offish, and it's not a criticism, I do better with hands-off advisors. I don't do well with people who are on top of me every day.
Yeah.
So it was something that worked pretty well for me. But at the same time, I do wonder if I'd had more direct mentoring, I might have done a bit better. Like there was a lot of meandering that took place. And in hindsight, when I think about the experiments that I did, I'm like, well, those were not particularly smart things to do. And in some ways, maybe that was good training to make your own mistakes. But at the same time, I might have been a little bit more productive if someone had occasionally stopped me and said, hey, that's not so great.
Yeah,
I was lucky to end up having the advisor that I did, in that he did not put a lot of pressure on us. He let us be ourselves and get on with it.
Well, in that grad school period, when did you decide that you wanted to be a professor? Or was it kind of the same? I would like to continue what I'm doing.
Yeah, I had not decided during my PhD that I would like to be a professor. It was more, okay, I'm enjoying this, I'd like to do a postdoc. And then it was more during the postdoc that I thought, okay, maybe I'll give this thing a shot. Another different thing about the UK is that the PhDs are quite a bit shorter. So it's a 3-year PhD. I think 3 years is a little bit too short, really. So I definitely needed the additional 2 years of being a postdoc to try and figure things out. Once I was a postdoc, I mean, I've always been that person who's a little bit 1 foot out of the door type person. Maybe it's like a self-protection mechanism. But even as a postdoc, when I was thinking about becoming a professor, it wasn't like I was necessarily 100% committed. I was like, well, I'll apply. If I get interviews, that's great. If I don't, that's fine too. I'll figure out something to do. And same with the interviews. I was like, well, if they offer me a job, that's great. If not, I'll figure out something to do. So I was never like fully, fully committed. Maybe that was my way of trying to protect myself from disappointment.
What big challenges did you have to face to get to where you are now?
I guess the most obvious one is being a female scientist, because that is what I am. I was very, very lucky to feel pretty sheltered from that as a PhD student and a postdoc. Like, I don't, maybe it was just because I was used to being outnumbered. But then again, I didn't necessarily feel I was discriminated as a graduate student or postdoc. It was really once I became a faculty member that I started feeling it more and more, like just day to day being underestimated. People tend to underestimate me quite a bit because I'm soft-spoken, I'm quiet, I don't speak out much. So people do tend to underestimate me. And there were definitely comments that were made, like, I have a colleague who's well-intentioned, and I don't think, I really genuinely think that he's being nice about it. But at the same time, like, it's not really that great. Like, you know, when we have a seminar speaker in the department, you know, the seminar speaker goes from office to office meeting with different faculty members. And if he was the one handing the seminar speaker off to me, he would always introduce me as the best looking faculty member in the department. Yeah. And yeah, and I actually think he thought he was being nice, but it wasn't really, it's not professional in my opinion anyway. Like, I'd rather be known for my science. Other things that would happen were there were faculty members who were clearly uncomfortable having one-on-one meetings with me. And then there were other times when a faculty member would ask to have coffee with me, thinking, and I would turn up thinking that it was actually going to be a work, like maybe a science discussion. And then I'd get there and I was like, I don't think this is what this is. I've encountered more of those once I became a faculty member, for sure.
Has the job been what you imagined it would be?
Yes and no. Like the research part, yes. The research part has always been fun. And one of the things that I hadn't anticipated when I first became an assistant professor is how much I would enjoy the teaching portion. That has definitely been a big reward, like encountering, meeting the students, getting to know the students. That's been much more fun. Well, when I say much more fun, I was super naive when I started as an assistant professor, so I just didn't have any expectations there. But then the hard part has been the interpersonal relationships that I hadn't quite realized to the extent that we would encounter politics when dealing with like department issues, for example. Yeah. And I think I would say that to this day, it's those interactions that wear me down the most, for sure.
What is a typical day like for you?
Like, well, COVID times, it means once I sit down at my corner desk at home, it's just Zoom meetings. Well, so my role has changed quite a bit too in this past year because I became interim chair. And that has been relentless in terms of just Zoom back-to-back-to-back-to-back meetings that I literally don't have any gaps in my schedule as interim chair. So that's a unique chair situation plus unique chair pandemic situation.
Yeah.
But normally, like, my typical day would be like, it would be a mix of teaching a class, having office hours, having meetings with my graduate students or postdocs, but trying to do my own work as well. So reviewing papers, writing proposals, writing papers. But generally, yeah, it's varied in the sense that, yeah, we get to think about a lot of different research projects, get to read a lot of different papers. And when we were traveling, there was also a lot of traveling that happened, going to conferences, going to workshops and so on.
You have a big move coming up. How's that going?
Yeah, the pandemic has, that's another thing the pandemic has made very difficult because Japan's not really letting people in right now. So planning for it has been, well, challenging. But a lot of it was for personal reasons that I decided to leave. Like, it was not relate to anything that I was unhappy, for example, at the University of Washington. So sometimes people ask, is it a push or a pull? It's more of a pull. It's not a push that I was like, oh, I can't stand being here. It was not that at all. It was more that, well, my parents live in Japan, and because I left when I was 12, it's been quite a long time since I've been anywhere near my parents. So that was a big drive. My brother lives in London, but he is actually also making the move to Japan. So like all of our family are getting together. And I have two kids. One is 2 and 1 is 4. And I just been feeling like it would be great if they could see grandparents more. So there's a lot of personal reasons that I'm going. But then there's also like curiosity about the institute as well. Like it's a very, very unique institute. It's not like any other university in Japan. It's very international. Like it has a good mixture of Japanese professors as well as international professors. In terms of research, they've embraced this multidisciplinary approach. So it doesn't have departments at all. Like you just have these research group units. So the idea is that you don't get siloed into different areas. And so I was just really attracted to this global network of scientists, as well as this being interactive, not in terms of nationality, but also in terms of research, that there were no boundaries. That was very appealing. So, I mean, it's a new institute, and I'm sure it'll go through growing pains as it grows and it figures itself out. But nevertheless, very excited about the new opportunity. And I guess the CNN news highlighted a few things. Like, I felt a little bit guilty about that article because it painted my experiences perhaps negatively. And, you know, because I look white, I haven't faced the challenges that others have faced. And so I felt a little bit guilty about being in that article in the first place. Having said that, though, I mean, I have like seen up close the racism that the treatment that people get, and both in Japan and well, everywhere really. That's the thing. Like, I don't think there's anywhere that's not racist. So I don't think that. I mean, moving to Japan will have its own challenges itself, but I will admit that the past 4 years may have wanted me to distance myself a little bit from things.
Yeah, definitely. And also coming home is nice.
Yeah, coming home is nice. And it's a little tricky. Home is tricky for me because, you know,
yeah,
I was in an old Japanese school and the only white looking kid. And, you know, I was treated differently. And so it feels like home. It's very familiar, and I like being there. But at the same time, I know I will be treated differently. So it's a little complicated.
Yeah, it's similar for me going back home. I'm from a really Southern Christian conservative place, and you know, I had a hard time growing up as the gay kid. And so, you know, you want to come back home, but it still has its nostalgia, but some of it's
a little bit
as well. It's a complicated relationship.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, Japan is known for being a little bit of a sexist country. So when I was little and I left, I kind of told myself, I'll go back when I'm more in a position of power. Yeah. I thought maybe I might be able to affect change.
What do you do outside of lab? Do you have any hobbies, or what are you besides a scientist?
My biggest gig right now is being a mom as well.
That is a big gig.
Yeah. I have to admit, you know, when we talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion, when I became pregnant was the time I fully appreciated, wow, this equality thing is, I mean, there is no equality, really, is the real sense I got. Like, you know, the 9-month pregnancy, the changes that your body has to go through. And I mean, men don't go through that. I had a colleague tell me while I was sort of maybe about 7 or 8 months pregnant, he was like, yeah, just remember, it's hard for the man too, because all we can do is wait. And I'm like, what? Like, just waiting is a lot easier than this thing that's happening to me right now. Like, I think somebody told me one time that the changes a woman's body goes through in that 9 months is far more than a man will experience in their entire lifetime. Like, they never have to go through that. And then even after giving birth, the whole, well, I guess like people have choose differently, but in my case, I decided to breastfeed, and that's pretty intense. And like, even once I was back on campus, having to worry about pumping and trying to make sure I scheduled times in the day and to make sure that I could pump. Like, when dads go back to work, all they have to do is work. Whereas if you're a nursing mother, you go back to work, but you never, it's, you don't get to do that. You still have to worry about other things. So I became a mom quite late, because I am in my early 40s right now. But yeah, my first son, he was born in my late 30s. So it took me longer than most women to realize this. But I did think, man, this gig, this thing, it doesn't even compare. Men have it really easy. It was the really kind of frank feeling I got out of all of that. Men have it super easy. Yeah, and my husband's super supportive, by the way. Like, he shoulders a lot, but then in those early days, yeah, some tasks can really only literally be done by the mom. And no, I mean, I enjoyed it. I'm not resentful of it or anything like that. But I did think it was not equal. And then just the other things, like, you know, the parental leave that happens afterwards, you know, usually both the mother and father get the same deal at a university. Mm-hmm. And you know, I actually have colleagues who became fathers who use that 1 quarter off to do lots of traveling, to go to conferences, for example. And I'm like, that's not fair. So there are a lot of things that I realized after becoming a mom that I was like, wow, equality is not the same thing as equity. And equity is the one that we really need to work for. But I completely derailed what you actually asked. So what do I do outside of work? So at all point in my career, even as a PhD student, like, work-life balance was something that was important to me. And admittedly, as a graduate student, it wasn't so intentional. I don't think I even knew the phrase work-life balance, to be honest. But I've always been that person who needs time outside of work. So I try to be pretty disciplined in my working hours. I typically avoid working weekends as much as I can. Admittedly, sometimes there are deadlines, which means that I do work weekends, but most weekends I actually try to avoid. Hobbies have definitely been exercise. I go through different phases for the different sports I do. For a long time, it was actually rowing. I don't do that anymore. This past year has been running. So like last weekend, I just did a half marathon and stuff. So getting out there and trying to do things. I think exercise is good for being in academia. Like, it helps to clear the mind, but also I think it builds resilience, which helps with work.
So now for a big question. What is the future of science, or what do you hope it is, and what is your role in that future?
So for my personal vision is that science will be truly global, without barriers, accessible to everyone. And I don't think it's very accessible to everyone right now. And
fortunately.
And I think that's why I'm particularly excited about this move to OIST, because at least on paper, it embraces that it's an international organization. So I think, and thinking about my other roles that I play right now, one of the roles that I have is that I'm currently serving in IUPAC, and I'm the Polymer Division President. And generally, I mean, you can go to IUPAC's page and they have a mission. I'm going to have to Google it too. But their mission generally is to foster sustainable development, provide a common language for chemistry, and advocate the free exchange of scientific information. And that mission itself does actually speak to me, that we do want to clearly communicate science, in this particular case, chemistry, but also make it the information really freely accessible. So I guess through that, we do have a lot of activities going on. Like we currently have like 30 projects running within the Polymer Division on its own. And some of it is updating Wikipedia. Wikipedia is great, but it's not always 100% accurate. So trying to make sure that we get the correct terminology into Wikipedia. We also have like a polymer education subcommittee where we're doing more work with developing countries to try and get like polymer knowledge out there. And as mundane as it seems, like we do a lot of work with nomenclature and terminology. And I do think that it's really important to get that bit right, because just little nuances actually change the meaning of what you're talking about. So trying to make sure that we're using a common language to talk about everything. So yeah, we have a lot of nomenclature terminology projects. But I guess in terms of going back to your original question of where do I think science is going, a much more of a global collaborative endeavor is what I hope it will be. Like this past year, the pandemic, for example, we could have done so much better if we had acted globally, but we didn't. And I think we should. So yeah, a global collaborative endeavor. And I hope that I can play a role in it, for example, through participating in IUPAC, being part of a global institution like OIST, and doing my bit in promoting equity. And for me, what's most familiar is being a female scientist, so trying to promote women in science, for example.
I didn't think about IUPAC and the meaning of having a universal language.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty cool, because at the time when we were learning like IUPAC naming and organic.
Yeah, it's like, oh my God, this is so genius. Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I know that that's the reputation that IUPAC has. But no, we do a lot more other projects. So I would encourage people to look at the IUPAC website.
Yeah, that's actually really cool, because I also didn't think about the meaning of having this universal language that everybody could use.
And we do actually quite a bit of translating as well. Making sure that the terms used in other languages equate properly as well.
That's really cool. Are you ready for a high throughput lightning round?
All right.
What is your favorite hot drink?
Hot chocolate. That's my guilty secret every night. Every night, hot chocolate.
That's awesome. What would you be if you weren't a scientist?
I always told myself that if I didn't get tenure, I was going to become a massage therapist. I don't know. I get tight shoulders a lot and just generally get in pain every now and then. And I'm a pretty good masseuse, so that was what I was.
What piece of lab glassware would you be?
A condenser. It's cooling and soothing.
What is your favorite place in the world?
Oh, wow, that's tricky. I like a lot of places. That's one of the benefits of being a faculty member, that we have gotten to travel a lot. But for nostalgic, well, personal reasons, I have a soft spot for Iceland, because that's where I went for my honeymoon.
If you could have any superpower,
What would you choose?
Night vision. For multiple for reasons, like I'm actually a little bit scared of the dark, so it likes night. I have pretty bad astigmatism, which makes driving at night hard. Like the lights are blurry and hard to see.
Yeah.
So being able to see better in the dark, I would like.
What is your favorite or least favorite part of being a chemist?
Favorite part is, like, you know, everything's made of molecules and we get to think about that every day. I find that fun. The least favorite part is how people talk about chemicals as being a bad thing. And I'm just like, everything is made of chemicals. What are you talking about? Like, you're made up of a chemical. So, yeah, comments like that really hurt me.
What do you want to be known for?
You know, like, research comes and goes. Early on, I wanted to be known for one particular research thing. But I think the older I get, I would rather be known for someone who hopefully was compassionate in how they dealt with others.
Do you have any advice for younger students who want to become a professional scientist?
So, especially becoming a professor can be a tough gig. Like, it is not always easy. So I think my advice for them would be just remember that there's many different ways that you can be successful. Like, success can take different forms. There is no one way that you can be successful. So bearing that in mind, just be true to yourself. Be yourself. You don't have to try and be someone else. And be kind to yourself and to those close to you. And if you get that bit right, then you should be successful in whatever you do.
Have you thought about something you've learned that blew your
mind? Oh, man. I feel like there should be something. You know, reading my kids' books actually surprised me on a regular basis. I'm like, I didn't know this when I was 4, or like, I didn't even know that now. But one of the dinosaurs, like one I thought was like a big dinosaur, turned out not to be a thing. They discovered that actually someone had previously discovered it and already had a name. But there's like actually a lot of things that I read in my kids' books that I'm like, oh, so maybe this is totally naive. The other thing I recently learned through my kids is that fish don't close their eyes. Or rather, they can't close their eyes.
That's weird.
And I didn't know that.
Yeah, I wouldn't have ever thought about a fish not closing their eyes or closing their eyes.
But yeah, I'm reading these kids' books and I'm like, how did I not know this? And I'm a scientist. Right?
Well, I think we just get so specific. And then we learn things outside of it. I'm like, oh, okay. That doesn't look like an oak tree, but I guess that's an oak tree because there are acorns on it.
Yeah.
Where can people find you on the internet?
I think for my professional life, Twitter is the best. Admittedly, I'm not as active as some on Twitter, but yeah, that would be the best place.
What is your handle?
At LascomUW. And which reminds me, I guess if I move, I'm going to have to change this.
But thank you so much. I wanted to talk to you selfishly because I think you're a really interesting person and I wanted to like get to know you and ask these questions. And so it was like, they're like, oh, who are you interviewing next? And I'm like, I'm gonna ask Christine because I think she's really cool and I want to know things about her.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that.
Find us on the internet. Check out nsf-cchf.com or nsf-cchf on Twitter and Instagram. Find me at rachelshall.com or rachelshall on Twitter. This episode was produced with help from Kevin Gonzalez, Nick Garcia, and Rio Febrian. Show art by Rio Febrian. Show theme written by Nick Garcia. Show edited by me. Thank you for listening. I hope you'll join us next time.